Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Kate Bailey and Emma Ajimang, Deputy Personal Finance Editor and Personal Finance Writer at Investors Chronicle. We also have special guest Peter Doherty, Managing Partner and Chief Investment Officer of Tideway Investment Partners. Like much of the rest of the world, you're probably still digesting the news that controversial property tycoon Donald Trump will soon have control of the world's largest nuclear arsenal, let alone the effect that his victory has had on world markets over the last 2 days. Now, this might make US equities seem like the last place you want to be as an investor, but Emma, you've been looking at this area and talking to the experts about it, and they don't take this view. Why is this?
That's right. History suggests that presidential elections actually have a limited impact on US markets. So research that was done by ETF provider Source found that 6 months after the last 11 US elections, bonds, equities and the US dollar had all made gains. And the total of treasuries and equities return was about 4%. So, you know, arguably a lot less impact than people generally tend to think.
Okay. Now, are there any other reasons why these experts said that you might want to have an exposure to US equities?
Yes. I mean, many of the people we spoke to said that, you know, the US has some of the most innovative companies in the world. Just think of the so-called FAANG companies, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix and Google. So technology, their leading technology makes this market a really sort of attractive one. And then the other key thing that drives the US economy is consumption. And that, some of the experts we spoke to said, is well supported by, you know, continued low unemployment, low energy, a strong housing market and positive wage growth. Some of the other people we spoke to were also quite bullish about the US's sort of economic growth going forward, and the fact that they think that this bull run, although it's been going on in sort of the second longest bull run on record, but the fact that we haven't had sort of normal growth since the financial crisis suggests that there actually still might be some way for this bull run to run. At least that was some of the things that some of the arguments the people we spoke to were suggesting.
Okay, now that all sounds good, but are there any reasons other than the next US president as to why you might not want to invest in US equities?
Yes, the key sort of question really is about company profits. Some of the people we spoke to sort of felt that, you know, company profits peaked earlier this year, and that with US shares looking expensive compared to their history, it might not be a good time to sort of be looking to invest in this area. There's also concerns about the strong dollar, which the people we spoke to who were less sort of, you know, more bearish on the US felt that it was hurting companies' competitiveness, you know, overseas. And then particularly for UK investors, there's a worry of sterling's weakness against the dollar. So, you know, do you really want to be using your weak pound to buy expensive US shares? So that's something that investors need to weigh up.
Okay. Peter, do you think Donald Trump poses a risk to the returns you could get from US equities?
Well, I think it's a very mixed picture. I think there are some positives and more positives than negatives. So I think in terms of having Trump as president, I mean, one of the main challenges that Obama faced was not having control of the entire process. So in terms of wanting to actually execute policies, that was very challenging. Trump and the Republicans have the House, the Senate, all the executive committees. So it's most likely that they'll be able to actually implement what they want to. And that may sort of uncork or free up some of the resources that otherwise be stuck. There's a well-known narrative around infrastructure investment. And, you know, whilst bond yields have actually quite significantly retraced this week since the result, they're still at low levels. And so I imagine that the US is in a position to borrow effectively at low rates and invest. And that could be supportive of equities. I would say, on the other hand, though, we're starting from quite an expensive valuation. If you look at a number of different metrics, whether it's profits as a proportion of the valuation, if you look at Tobin's Q and other measures, there are some signs of sort of mini bubble. And, you know, one of the things that's been going on, which will probably unwind now, is companies borrowing through the corporate bond market to either pay dividends or buy back shares. As bond yields go up, that will stop. And that is one quite meaningful leg of support that will be removed from now.
Do you have any other concerns? I mean, one thing that sprung to mind was the possibility of a Federal Reserve interest rate rise. Do you think that's going to happen? And is it a risk to the path of US equities?
I think we're getting into slightly difficult territory there, because obviously Trump has made some comments about the fact that he thought the Fed was political. They kept rates low for Obama. They're going to raise rates on him, if you like. But I think there's a view that if the government is spending and is going for fiscal expansion, particularly, as Emma said, based on very low unemployment and quite a busy economy, there is a case to raise rates. And so December Fed fund rate rise is now back on the table, and people are talking about having two or three or more of those next year. It's very hard to see equities running away on the upside if you end up moving the discount rate from, half to 1% up to sort of 2 or 3 normalized percent. I mean, that could put some pressure on equity valuations.
Okay. Now, like you say, it's a really mixed picture. So, I mean, what should investors do? Do you think investors should have an allocation in their portfolios to US equities at the moment?
I think they should. I mean, there are, as we've touched on, there are some world-class companies making very good profits, and in businesses that are quite resilient. That isn't going to change. I think if you, particularly as we talked about, as a sterling-based investor, if you're going to get the exposure, you might want to feed it in over a number of months to sort of average in. In that case, I mean, you've seen sterling's actually bounced back up to about 126 now. That was heading down towards 120. If that heads up into the 130s, which is very plausible, then you're going to end up with a currency loss as a sterling investor in a dollar asset. So you want to be scaling into those.
So currency considerations as well, then, another
yes, indeed.
Risk. Right. With that in mind, Emma, what kind of funds should investors use if they do decide they want to have an allocation to US equities?
Well, the big question here is whether to go active or passive, because the US is a sort of notoriously hard market for active managers to beat. We spoke to Tilney Best Invest, and they, some research that they'd done found that less than 7% of funds in the Investment Association North America sector had beaten the S&P 500 over the past 5 years. So, 93% of them hadn't beaten it. Mm. Some of the active funds that did beat the index include IC Top 100 fund, Fidelity American Special Situations. And this is a fund that sort of focuses on underperforming businesses where other investors aren't expecting a recovery, but they think that actually they've been overlooked. And over 5 years, it returned 156%. So, pretty good performance. And as I say, it beat the index. Other funds that have beaten the S&P 500 include Legg Mason Opportunity, Legg Mason Clearbridge US Large Cap Growth, and Dodge & Cox Worldwide US Stock. So, those are good active funds to consider as well. On the passive side of things, I mean, the main thing really is to look at a low ongoing charge. Yeah. And the fund that, we think it's got very, very attractive ongoing charge of 0.07% is BlackRock's North American Equity Tracker Fund.
Okay, some useful ideas there. Peter, where do you sit in this debate? If you're going to invest in the US, should you go for an active or passive fund?
Well, we tend to do a little bit of both, actually. So we have our own in-house research for individual equities, and they can go into what we call a sort of bespoke portfolio. In addition, as Emma said, I think the very, very low cost trackers have some value, and that they're very useful to get some basic exposure. The other thing we also like to do is pick across the capital structure, if you like. So not only equities, but we have we have a lot of exposure to bond and credit bonds in particular. I mean, one sector which I think is it does have value and will benefit from a rising rate environment, of course, is the banking sector. In post the crisis, the US banks have dramatically increased the amount of capital they have. I mean, as much as sort of 4 to 6 times more capital now on a risk-weighted basis. As interest rates go up, those stocks will start to do very well. In fact, you've seen Bank of America is up almost 15% this month alone. So I think on the active side, I think you can pick individual names. There are some other ETFs that we like. There's PFF, which is the preferred stock ETF that has a yield of over 5%. And again, you've got assets there in the middle of the balance sheet, so you've got equity below you, and you're well protected from any risk of loss, really.
Okay. Are there any other funds you'd particularly flag?
Well, we have exposure to Scottish Mortgage Trust. You know, some of the active managers there with US exposure.
Okay, so that's actually a global fund, but with a meaningful US allocation.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then otherwise, we tend to pick by region. So we'll pick a UK income class, European equity, etc. Do it by region rather than global.
Okay. Thank you. Some useful suggestions, which neatly takes us on to our next subject. And that is, whatever view you take on US equities or any other regional asset, it's important to know how much you're exposed to in different areas and, very importantly, your overall asset allocation. This way you can make sure that you don't over or under allocate to any given asset. The problem here is, though, that some funds' names or sector categorisations don't give a clear indication of what they expose you to. Now, Emma, you've been looking at some examples of this, and that some funds typically have a high exposure to the US, even though it's not obvious from their names or sector categorisation. What are these types of funds, and how much are they exposed to the US?
Even if you don't hold any US funds, you may still have substantial exposure to the market via any global or global equity income funds that you hold. So, for example, the Association of Investment Companies have done some research recently, and they found that investment trusts in the global sector had an average of 36% to North America, and global equity income trusts had an average of 22%. So, you know, if you're not aware that actually your trust or your fund has quite a big exposure to, in this case, the US, that might be something you need to double check.
Okay. Why are global and global equity income funds so exposed to the US?
Well, one reason is that there's a benchmark they use. So many of them will use the MSCI World Index. And if they're closely following the index in terms of market allocation, that might be a reason that they have a high exposure. So the MSCI World Index has 59% in the US, and some investment trusts sort of match that completely. So, for example, Martin Currie Global Portfolio also has 59% in the US. Securities Trust of Scotland has 56%. And we mentioned Scottish Mortgage earlier, that has 48% exposure to the US.
Okay, so there's obviously the benchmark, but what other reasons do their managers give for having a high allocation to US equities?
Well, I mean, the manager of Martin Currie Global Portfolio, which, as I said, has 59%, says that the main reason is the exposure to the good growth outlook that the US offers compared to other developed countries. So, you know, he's taken a bet that actually the US is going to continue to do well. And that's why he wants, 60% of the portfolio exposed to the country. The manager at Securities Trust Scotland said that, in a similar sort of way, it's the macroeconomic conditions that the US has, the fact that they look like they're improving more than any other countries, and we've got this whole debate as to whether or not the Fed is going to raise interest rates. So that's the reason that he's given.
Yeah. Now, are there any global investment trusts that have less exposure to the US, and why?
Yes, there are. So the AIC's research found that Lindsay Train has 10%. Lord Devonshire Corporation also has a similar amount, as does Seneca Global Income and Growth. And the manager for Lord Devonshire said that, it's not so much that he doesn't like the US as he thinks that there are opportunities elsewhere. So in particular, he is favours the UK and says that the higher dividend yields available in the UK make them more attractive compared to other markets.
Okay. Now, Peter, you said yourself a few moments ago that you invest in Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, but you're actually using it to get US exposure because its exposure is really so substantial. So if investors are holding global equities funds, should they avoid holding US funds in case they become overexposed? Or, for example, if they've already got US funds, should they not buy a global fund similarly to avoid having overexposure to the US?
We raised some excellent points there. And one of the things that we do at Tideway is look through all of our funds and really weight the portfolio on an asset-by-asset basis. So it's very easy to say I'm going to buy half a dozen equity funds and think you're diversified, and they overlap, and you end up, for argument's sake, you might have HSBC in five of the funds. That's very poor. So one thing to do when you're buying a fund, I think you've alluded to it, is look beyond the headline, beyond the sector, and actually, let's say, pick the top 10 assets or 20 assets, pick those names, allocate the right amount of money to each fund, and end up with a sort of full look through on the portfolio. So I think, yes, in short, either say I'm going to only invest in very specific narrow regional funds, or pick a global fund. If you do mix the two, you have some risk of doubling up where you're not quite sure about that, unless you look through the actual underlying assets.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. Do you use any of the global funds or global equity income funds of your clients?
We use Linsdale Train, actually, so that was a good one to have mentioned for us. I think they're a great manager, good long-term track record, and again, are in businesses that are stable, long-term, high ROE businesses.
Okay, thank you. Some useful things to look out for there. Now, if you're a parent and you haven't already opened one, you might be thinking of starting a junior individual savings account, or junior ISA for short, to build up savings for your children. But this is just one of very many ways you could save for your children. So before you open a junior ISA, you should consider whether this or one of the very many other options is better for your situations and goals. Kate, what are some of the key considerations parents need to make when they start saving for children?
So I think one of the first things to think about is whether you want to save or invest. Obviously, investing can be, well, first, it can be a bit intimidating. And secondly, it can sound like something which you're really going to have to keep on top of. But in fact, it can be easy. You don't necessarily have to be watching a portfolio like this all the time. So firstly, that's something to think about. If you're saving in cash, your savings might not be keeping pace with inflation, and your returns could be pretty miserly compared to the returns you could get if you invest the money. And then you need to think about what you're saving for. So it's good to have a goal in mind. You might want to be saving for university. You might want to be saving for a deposit for your child's home. And again, those things could, rise above inflation. So that's something to think about as well when you're trying to choose between cash or investing. And I think actually another important thing to think about is your child's tax allowances. Because often when we're thinking about ISAs and SIPs, we're often thinking about making the most of tax-efficient saving. But in fact, your child does have quite a lot of tax allowances which they can max out. So it's less important to have tax-efficient wrappers here, I think. For example, children have a personal allowance of $11,000, and they won't be earning income. So that's quite a lot that you can save without tax being an issue. They have a dividend allowance, and they also have the personal savings allowance. So I think those are all things that are important to think about when you're deciding which route to go down.
Okay, now I think, as we said, there are lots and lots of options. So thinking about parents who want to invest rather than save, what are, let's say, maybe a couple of the options or examples of the options for investing for children?
So in terms of vehicle, you could think about a junior ISA. So that's one of the ones we most commonly hear about. So in that, you can save up to £4,080 a year, and the pot will grow tax-free. Your child does get control of it aged 18, which is a bit of a sticking point for some parents who don't want to hand that over to their child on their 18th birthday. And also JISAs, they can be stocks and shares or cash, obviously. And they're quite easy. There's a massive range of these. So you can kind of mix and match from fund supermarkets or kind of go down other routes. Another quite interesting one is an investment trust savings scheme. So this is a way of paying into an investment trust on a much cheaper way than if you bought one on a platform. And you can do it monthly or with lump sums. You're not charged any annual fees most of the time, and you can control when the child gets access. The downside of this is you get less flexibility than with a stocks and shares JISA. You can hold kind of one trust or trust from one fund house, and there aren't the same tax benefits. But it's a very low cost and kind of easy way to manage investments.
If you're starting from scratch, how do you go about building up an investment portfolio for your child?
Okay, so assuming you're starting from scratch and putting your maximum allowance in, you really only need to start with one fund in a JISA, for example. A good way to start out is to have one very globally diversified fund so that you've got kind of a spread of assets from around the world. And then when you get more money into it, kind of year by year, you can start to increase the number of funds in your JISA. And then start to think about having maybe a core and satellite approach. So your core might be some global funds, might be some more defensive funds. And around the edges, you might hold some higher risk ones. Because one key thing to think about when saving for children is you have got a long-term time horizon. So you can accept quite a lot of risk. In a way, you want risk or volatility because you want the fund to build and you've got time for the market to go up and down. So around the edges or smaller holdings, you might have emerging markets or Asian equities or just very high growth funds. And the maximum you'd ever want, say the experts, should be about 10 to 15 funds. And that would be, you know, when your fund reaches something like 50,000.
OK, and what kind of funds could you maybe populate this JISA with?
So for the core, you might want to look at things like Fidelity Global Dividend Fund, and that targets growth and income from stocks, global stocks. Or you might want to look at Lindsay Train Global Equity, which again is a global fund with a very good reputation. Or something like Fundsmith Equity, which targets 20 to 30 countries, which are very resilient to global change. And they've got quite defensive attributes, like the ability to sustain high return on operating capital. So it's things like that to start out with.
Okay, some interesting options. Now, turning to people who maybe want to save for children in cash, I mean, what sort of options do they have?
So you've got things like child savings accounts, obviously, which you can open up at banks or building societies. And then you've got things like premium bonds, which issued by the NS&I, a very popular savings product. And the benefit of that is that you have the potential of winning a prize regularly. So the money is obviously sitting in a bond and then you might win on a monthly basis. There are also NS&I children's bonds, and those are 5-year renewable bonds designed for children under 16. And those make a fixed interest payment each year, tax-free. The child gets control of the bond on their 16th birthday. With those, you can invest between £25 and £3,000 per bond issue in £25 units.
Okay. Thank you, Kate. Now, Peter, on the subject of cash, I think as Kate mentioned, it doesn't make such high returns as investments. So should parents saving for kids totally avoid cash investments?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there are the way we look at that is we have what's called a horizon view. So we will say to clients, if you need cash in 0 to 5 years and you're going to need that money, you want to be in cash or cash equivalent because you don't want to be selling maybe at a bad time. If you have a 5 to 10 year horizon for the money, then you can start to buy equities or some other medium term investments. And then 10 years plus, you can go long only equities and manage through any volatility. So that first piece, 0 to 5 years cash equivalent, is really if you're going to need the money. I think if you're investing for your children long term, you probably want to be avoiding cash at the moment, only because you're going to get a sort of negative real return. You know, rates are still going to be around 1.5% in the UK, and inflation is probably going to be a little bit above that.
Okay, and I mean, just thinking about when cash would be a good option, what would be possibly instances or time frames, examples, parents maybe wanting to have some or all of their investments in cash?
Yeah, I think if you're going to need the money, what you don't want to be doing is investing in an asset which may go down a few percent or more just because of market volatility, and then you find yourself selling at a bad time. So I think if you have a reasonable expectation that you're going to need some cash, that really should be in cash. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Okay, some really helpful points. Thank you, Pete. And you can see the full roundup of different ways to save for children in this week's money section in the magazine or online. That brings us to the end of this week's show. So it just remains to thank Kate Bealey and Emma Ajimang, Deputy Personal Finance Editor and Personal Finance Writer at Investors Chronicle, and special guest Peter Doherty, Managing Partner and Chief Investment Officer of Tideway Investment Partners. You can read more about whether to invest in US equities, global investment trusts, and saving for children in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle and the website, Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.